Hi, I'm Charmaine Matlock-Turner, President and CEO of the Urban Affairs Coalition, and you're listening to Driving Change. UAC remains a place for dreamers, doers, big thinkers, and visionaries. Joining me in this episode is someone whose personal journey personifies UAC and mirrors UAC's journey. I'm thrilled to introduce to some, reintroduce to others, and just say hey, bro, to Arun Prabhakaran, the new Executive Vice President of the Urban Affairs Coalition. While Arun may have a new title at UAC, he is not new to us, and we couldn't be happier to have him back. Welcome back, Arun.
Hey, Charmaine.
Hey, sis.
What's going on?
Always good to see you and hear you. Arun, I know you've been a longtime activist fighting for social justice, but take us back a little bit. What brought you to Philadelphia, and how did you start getting involved in causes that really made an important difference in our community?
There's a beautiful saying, which is the two most important days in your life are the day you're born and the day you find out why. I found out my why early in life, but I didn't really have a clear, defined path on that. And there's another saying, which is comes out of a Tolkien book, which is not all who wander are lost. Some of us are seekers. I grew up in a family where my father was an immigrant, and he was one of seven children who survived of 15. There was a hunger, malnutrition, disease in post-colonial India, and his family suffered greatly at that. And, you know, he had the immigrant story. We worked hard, came to this country and worked hard and made a life here. So as I was growing up, I was instilled with these values of both what was it like in that post-colonial struggle, but also what did it mean to fight for something? My father was an activist when he was a young man, but also this idea of like poverty and hunger and our duty as a society to uplift everybody. You know, I went to school. I was very idealistic. I was a young activist in high school. I became a death penalty abolitionist in my senior year at my Jesuit high school. I went to college. I was a student activist. I came to Philadelphia in part because my wife had been an intern at the DA's office, which isn't really central to her story. It's just she fell in love with Philadelphia when she was here and she came back. And I got involved. I got involved right away in issues of police brutality. I started protesting the DA's office around the death penalty. Later, I joined the Kensington Welfare Rights Union and the Poor People's Economic Human Rights Campaign, started getting arrested in civil disobedience. And there was this guy who would come around and be our pro bono counsel. His name was Larry Krasner. I got to know Larry as a man of conscience, a man of character, a man of action early on in my time here in Philadelphia. And I continue to have a relationship with him, even as my activism continued, my work in the nonprofit sector continued. I launched the first city's first harm reduction oriented drop-in center for kids who are doing sex for money for drugs, a place to stay, avoid HIV and AIDS. I actually didn't know it at the time, but I was working hand in hand with a lot of UAC programs. In fact, I used to ride around in my van. I used to have UAC folks in my van as one of the program partners, UACAP. And then I, you know, came to UAC. I worked at UAC. I loved it. I worked at UAC for 9 really meaningful years. You know, as Charmaine knows, I started advising the DA before he announced his election. I was one of the people who helped him get up off the fence, as they say. I was an advisor to him during his campaign. And then when he won the primary, throughout that time, he had been asking me if I would consider coming in. I was like, Larry, what would I do in a DA's office? I love what I do. I love UAC. And he kept on asking me and kept on asking me. And about 5 months in, I started to feel this sense of obligation, like I had started something bigger than me. And I didn't know what that meant. And I also knew Larry, he didn't have somebody like me in his mix. Let me say that. Somebody who had some of the inside political experience, had some of the management experience, had some of the turnaround work that I did at UAC. My wife and I took a vacation, which ended with a civil rights pilgrimage. And we went to Dr. Martin Luther King's house. And that was the house where he got the call from Reverend E.D. Nixon asking him to lead the Montgomery Improvement Association. And his response was, I got to get these kids to school. I can't be running around doing all this stuff. So I'm sitting down at that breakfast table. And one of his contemporaries, a woman who met Dr. King when he was Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., he was a young, smart preacher, said, I want you to listen to this. And she puts on this tape, and it's this speech about how sometimes you have to do things that are bigger than yourself. You have to make sacrifices. And it just unleashed all of these feelings inside of me that I wasn't really ready for. And then we drove to Selma, and then we drove to Birmingham. And then I called Larry from Birmingham and said I would be his chief of staff. And I had to break the news to Charmaine, but I told her that it was a sacrifice I was making. It was a sacrifice because sacrifice is the root word is sacred, right? It's you don't give up something that you don't like. The only sacrifice is when you give up something that's important to you to do something bigger. So that's what I did. And at the DA's office in 29 months, I think we had one of the most important and transformative progressive district attorney's offices that helped shape the landscape that now is leading to all these protests and demonstrations that we've seen over the last few months. I think, one, we hired one of the most diverse classes in the history of the office, actually two of them. We ended effectively the death penalty in Philadelphia. We reduced the prison population with our criminal justice partners by half, which had already been decreased by 3,000 before. We significantly reduced the number of people who were needed bail to get out of jail for nonviolent offenses.
Yeah, I know. I remember we were working on a bail program at UAC yep. right before this. So you got a chance to carry that on and do it anyway. Yes.
Right. I got a way to get that done.
Yes.
Because, you know, Charmaine, we get things done. So, you know, and I think that those things are longstanding demands of not only communities of color. Some of them are controversial, but definitely. And I think that there are also longstanding demands of kind of the movement writ large, because what we know is that while the disproportionate effects have definitely been for people of color and the Black community, the reality is it's destroying our country to have mass incarceration. It's destroying our country to have mass supervision. It is really eats away at public trust to have unfair tactics, whether it's in the DA's office or in policing or in jails or in the courts. And ultimately, that our country has been a place where people can take their views, make them known, organize, and fight for their rights. And ultimately, those fights turn into institutional changes. And those institutional changes hopefully steer us back to the highest values of our society. I know we have a lot of values that are being challenged right now, and many of them need to simply go away. But our highest values still remain a shining light.
Well, I think that the work that you did in the DA's office is absolutely amazing. And it's easy to do and sort of talk about almost from hindsight. But I know how difficult it was. People were very, very skeptical. There was still this sense that law and order will be not where we focus. And we're going to be sort of like letting people who should be in some way locked away back into communities. And this sense of justice being important was not on the radar. But now we're at a time where, which I keep hoping that this is a movement and not a moment. And I know movements occur not always on headlines, right? So
right.
When I sort of look at the changes and where we are, where people are protesting and saying, look, we need to end racism in America. We need to end racism in the world. We know that that didn't just happen because of the tragic, tragic murder of George Floyd. But those kind of seminal moments galvanize all of us and reminds us of all the hard work that has to continue. So as you know, the coalition, you know, we've been here, we celebrated our 50 years this year. So as you sort of look forward to coming back to UAC and knowing the changes that you've been able to institute in the DA's office, the great work that you did at UAC before you went to the DA's office, and really helping us think strategically and with a strong vision, where do you think we are now? And what can you do to make sure that we're continuing to drive positive change, especially for communities of color and especially for those who are at the lowest income levels?
What I think at an individual level I see in coming back to UAC is I want to bring with me the spirit that we all, I think, have at UAC of trying to take one impossible thing at a time. Nelson Mandela once said, everything's impossible until somebody does it. And for me, coming back to UAC is a place where that kind of change is possible. It's not just talk change. It's not just change of a person at the top of an institution, but it is actually lasting change that is a part of communities. And that's what I really have always cared about. You know, for me, the world is changing and communities are changing. We are living in the middle of the fourth industrial revolution, which is the digital revolution. And I've been working, as Charmaine knows, on these issues for almost a decade about getting communities ready for the digital age. And I think that we have really thought this out very carefully. And we have a very smart strategy that's comparable to any of the other world-class institutions. And we have an opportunity, which is rare for a community-based African-American-led organization, despite the fact that it is the largest and oldest African-American-led fiscal sponsor in the country. It's rare for an organization like ours to have a shot at something truly transformative to the communities at a scale at which we probably haven't fully conceived of yet. So looking forward, UAC is the perfect place for something like this to happen. What I know is that the digital revolution is forcing change at a rate that we can't expect. This future is accelerating towards us in ways both by innovation and the changes caused by COVID. I know that it's somebody, I didn't even really know what Zoom was 3 minutes ago, and now I'm being interviewed, you know, on Zoom with you. But these changes are happening for reasons, right? And the reason why is because the digital revolution has changed the economics of the society. And, you know, all the old political folks will talk about the theory of politics, which is a change in technology turns into a change in the economy that turns into a change in the social environment, which then ripples forward and makes political change. And we are in the midst of that social push because the data companies are the biggest companies in the world right now. 5 years ago, it was oil companies. And they're going to change public policy. They're going to change governance. They're going to change social impact. They're going to change finances. They're going to change where's money is and how it moves. And they're going to change how value is created. And UAC is in the age where it needs to be a high-tech, high-touch center for nonprofit excellence. And data is now the renewable data is the renewable resource that touches every single thing that we do. And we are in the position to, in a 18-month sprint, I think, to really transform the work that we do and really build the spirit of the work in a true partnership with our programs, putting them and the relationships we have with them really at the center of our business model.
Well, Arun, I know that we have a lot of work to do and that we're absolutely committed to being not only the largest in the country, but really the best in the country. Because in the end, as you started out sort of sharing with us, you got into this because of your own personal family history, and then sort of understanding how those same kinds of challenges were there for other people in our city and in our region. And if we can really work together driving change, then we have the ability to impact individuals, families, communities, our city, the state, the country, and ultimately the world. And so a lot of times when we think about delivering service, we see a lot of sort of like the ability for us to meet people and hand out food and provide direct service. But that sort of secret sauce, I think, is the coalition, because in order for those things to work really well, systems need to work really well that support that work. And you've been such a great advocate for us not forgetting who we're serving, but helping us to better understand how we can do it better, faster, smarter, and more effectively. So welcome home, Arun.
Thank you, Charmaine.
Thank you, everyone, for joining us today in Driving Change. Unfortunately, we're running out of time, but the good news is that you'll be able to just call the coalition and say, can I talk to Arun? And you'll be able to hear the rest of the story and catch up on exactly where we are and what we're doing to really, really, really make a difference in our communities. We're not going to let this be a moment. It is going to continue to be a movement. We've been doing it for 50 years, and we are definitely laying the groundwork for the future. And as we say at the Coalition, we're just getting started. So thank you, everyone. Have a great day, and talk to you again soon as we continue to drive change.